We have Mia Vallee from the Graduate Center of CUNY, who I guess is...
Yeah, she's
En route.
A second away.
Moments away from being in this very room, and Vakhtang Gallimhari.
I'm sorry? Calamari sounds good, but...
No, everyone's entitled to pronounce their...
No, it's okay, we don't need to do that. Yeah, it's me.
Gallimhari?
Yeah.
Okay, from who will also be speaking on that side there. So it's a bit of a coin flip on which side is going in. On the other hand, on the one side, we have two people here, so it might be appropriate for that side to go first here. So a question for us here is, should we go 2-2 or should we go 1-1-1-1 and really mix it up here? Do people here have any sort of preference for what you think might make things a little bit more lively, and then we'll open it up to Q&A for everybody afterward.
That's
there.
Me.
So, all right, no strong preference here.
I think we would rather do chessboard. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Go back and forth.
Okay, I think that would actually make it a little bit more interesting here. So, we'll do a flip of the coin here on who will go first here. So, Doug, call it in the air.
Okay. Tails.
Tails, and it is... it is tails.
All right.
So it's your choice to go first or second.
Good. How much do I owe you for that?
All right. So first up, we'll be hearing from Doug Lane of Zero Books.
Okay.
The topic is from surplus value to surplus enjoyment or surplus jouissance. And... here's what I want to say. There are several important concepts or categories in Marx's Capital that are not immediately obvious to people who are reading him for the first time, or worse, reading extracts from the book out of context, something that I suspect happens all too often in university. For this debate at the Left Forum, the concept that has to be grasped is something like its full context, is the idea of labor power. If we're going to assert that we can not only hold with Lacanian ideas about the psyche, while simultaneously holding with Marx's critique of political economy, but more can turn to Lacan to correct Marx, we have to spend enough time on Marx in order to properly judge this Zizekian-Lacanian intervention and correction. So in his book on Zizek's dialectics, Fabio Vihi quotes from Capital at some length. But despite appearing to accurately transcribe the text, and I'm not enough of a Marx scholar to be able to tell which of the translations he's working from, and also often interpreting the text's meaning correctly, Vihi goes on to misinterpret what he quotes in a way that makes me suspect that his previous quotes and paraphrases might be something more akin to recitation than interpretation. The move that Vihi makes is this. He asserts that abstract labor that is a source of value for commodities, the abstract labor that Marx grants his bourgeois opponents, is working perfectly to determine exchanges in the market with a law-like regularity. Marx imagines, in order to clarify the theory, that 20 yards of linen is always exchanged for, or at least when it is exchanged, it's always exchanged for precisely the correct number of coats, and not the wrong number. So one coat is the traditional amount for 20 yards of linen. In Vihi's terms, he thinks that this labor, the abstract labor, is coterminous with real, useful living labor in all of its sensuousness. That is, after quoting Marx at length, he disposes of his category, Marx's category of abstract labor time, with a series of mystifying turns of phrases and changes in register that I can't help but think were born out of a sincere effort to grapple with Lacan's notion as primary and then apply them to a critique of political economy that no longer matters in this world. This is an attempted resuscitation of Marx that has gone terribly wrong. It's like offering a man who is dying of thirst a cup of gasoline. The fact that this Lacanian improvement on Marx is delivered by those who follow Zizek, a radical philosopher who is often an insightful critic of half-baked social democratic non-solutions for what are problems that are endemic to a system that most can't imagine living outside of or without, just makes the poison more difficult to take. Quoting Zizek, Vihi writes, A minimal shift of perspective reveals that what we perceive as value is actually, in its deepest connotation, the inerasable lack at the heart of being from which the little A, the petit A, emerges, this thing in us more than ourselves. Now, despite the bitterness of my previous remarks, I want to say that I admire Zizek's attempt to bring his understanding of Lacan and Hegel to his political interventions, and as a fellow traveler with the Zizekians, I can even work out a way to interpret this quote so that it's helpful, even for the most avowed Marxist. However, before I can do that, I want to point out how it's wrong. What Zizek describes is, on the level of economics operations, strictly wrong. Surplus value in no way relies on the subjective attitudes or understanding of the worker. This question of jouissance might be helpful if we're seeking out a psychological explanation for the working class's historical failure to overturn capitalism and replace it with socialism, but even there it probably misreads more than it clarifies. Here's where Zizek and Lacan go wrong. They imagine that what gives a commodity its value has to do with how it fills in the gap in a given individual's subjective understanding of his own personal world. This throws aside the whole of Marx's theory of abstract labor time and replaces it with a theory where subjective desire is what imputes value to a commodity. We end up in some psychoanalytic version of marginal utility theory, which, by the way, is a right-wing bourgeois theory of economics. Here's a relevant quote demonstrating the false move. But let's go back to capital's original act of vampirism, the first wage worker's surplus jouissance, co-substantial with the opaqueness of his knowledge at work, is surreptitiously sucked out of him, converted into value, and eventually injected into the produced commodity later purchased by that very worker who, with this act, sanctions his integration in the closed system of valorized enjoyment. Okay, so notice what Vihi has done. He started with description of labor power from capital. Labor power is what the worker exchanges with the boss for money. He sells his ability to work, sets up a contract where he agrees to do a set amount of labor, say 8 hours, in exchange for an amount of money with which he will be able to purchase the commodities he needs in order to feed himself, pay day's rent, maybe go to a show or get a beer. What he does not ask the boss to pay is some set of money that represents what 8 hours is actually worth, because abstract labor time does not have any value in itself and cannot be bought and sold on the market. Again, abstract labor time cannot be sold on the market and can't be bought on the market. Being the source of value, it has no value in itself. To ask how much money a set amount of time is worth is to get everything precisely backwards. Money does not determine the value of abstract labor time. Quite the opposite. Abstract labor time determines the value of money. To make this as clear as possible, we do not ask a car dealer how many miles are needed for every gallon of gasoline we put in our car. Nor do we think we can know what our mileage is going to be if we merely count up how many gallons of gasoline we have, but don't look at the car. To make this clearer still, we don't ask a carpenter to tell us the length of an inch by telling us how much or how many wood planks an inch contains. In the same way, we should not ask what the value of labor time is by asking how many yards of linen a labor hour is worth. We ask how many inches long a plywood board is, and we ask how many yards of linen can be produced in an hour. Now, I want to point out something that might make me sound a little bit like a bourgeois economist, but regardless of how it sounds, it remains true. When a boss hires a worker and pays him for his labor power, he's taking a risk. He cannot know in advance how many commodities the worker will produce, or whether he will, at the end of the day, end up with more value in widgets or iPods than he's paid the worker in food or shelter. If the worker shows up, collects his wages, but underproduces, the boss will have lost on his investment and still be required to pay the worker. After all, what the boss is paying for is not the value of the time, but rather the value of the contract to work, the labor power, however good or bad that happens to be. Now, it's quite possible that Marx got it all wrong. That is, perhaps abstract labor is a false category. Perhaps capitalism isn't a system of exploitation. Perhaps what determines prices isn't the value that Marx talks about, but our subjective desires instead. Maybe this gap, this extra amount of jouissance that the worker experiences in his productive activity is what gives the commodities we find in the market their value. But if this is true, then Lacan is not adding any understanding to Marx's theory, but rather to the theory of von Mises. I said before that there is a sense in which Zizek or Lacan's theory might be understood so that it's helpful for Marxists. Here's how. The value that Marx describes is not transhistorical or natural. It is not justified by God or logically necessary in any or every context. Rather, the value arises only from this capitalist epoch, and this is precisely why it can't be mistaken for the kind of use value that we usually imagine dictates and shapes our economic transactions. This value arises precisely because capitalism is how we fill in the gap in the world and between ourselves. It is how we organize ourselves socially in order to work and produce this world. But there is nothing natural or even utilitarian about this mode of production. Value does represent an ideological substance that does something other than fill our needs. And I agree with Zizek that the notion of a pure need is suspect, that we need, what we need always includes something more than a need. But it does this systematically and actively and not merely in the minds of individual workers. Capitalism is not merely an ideological specter that haunts the world, it is an objective force. We Marxists are the specters. If we can allow ourselves to read Marx's critique without letting bourgeois assumptions creep in, we can be more than specters. But we do have to guard against errors, even as we delight in letting our minds wander along with our comrades as they usher us through the loops of a Mobius strip and up and down Escher-like stairways. So there, that's my presentation, my opening remarks on surplus value instead of enjoyment.
All right, so I guess Mia's coming.
All right, Mia, you're next.
I'm going to draw these called Mobius strips and Escher staircase on the whiteboard.
Okay, so yeah, Vaho's going to sort of illustrate certain things that I'm talking about. I'm going to lay out some of the conceptual groundwork for our argument. And then Vaho's going to flesh it out, I think, in more detail. So I'll just start reading a quote from the book that Doug was talking about, Zizek's Dialectics by Fabio Vigi. And I think it captures pretty well the main thrust of what we're talking about. He says it was Lacan who proposed the homology between surplus value and surplus jouissance. My initial conception, largely unexplored by commentators, as Doug was saying, is that Marx's surplus labor is already in itself coterminous with Lacan's surplus jouissance, for it not only refers to the worker's unpaid labor time, but also to the excessive, incalculable quality of labor as such. Marx, however, did not develop this intuition. Instead, he stopped at surplus labor time, conceptualizing it as potentially detachable from surplus value and directly available to workers who, in a communist economy, would use it for the good of the whole society. Lacan's suggestion, by contrast, is that the genesis of surplus value, this invisible turbine at the heart of capitalist appropriation and accumulation, should be conceived less as non-remunerated labor time than as the entropic and non-quantifiable quality intrinsic to labor as such. So that's kind of a mouthful, and there's a lot of that to unpack. And so I'm going to try and lay out some groundwork to do that. So as is already clear, the issue here is the contention that the labor theory of value, which involves the reduction of labor to an abstract unit of measure based upon time, as the source and measure of abstract value under capitalist production, is not an adequate way to conceptualize the extraction of surplus under the capitalist mode of production. Of course, the labor theory of value is a contentious and often tricky concept to defend, even in some...
I think we're a little slower.
Okay. Sorry, I was rushing to get here, so maybe I'm still carrying that. So the labor theory of value is a contentious and often tricky concept to defend, even among Marxist economists, never mind in fields like Keynesian or post-Keynesian thought, where it is often dismissed offhand as reductionist for neglecting things like the omnipotence of price gouging or simply untenable and unproven on empirical grounds. Our argument, inspired by Lacan and Zizek, is that surplus value and surplus jouissance or enjoyment share more than a vague formal similarity wherein they would both refer to some excess over an original quantity. And in a way, surplus value is the very missing substance, surplus jouissance, I'm sorry, is the missing substance of surplus value. And to put it in more specific terms, let me first try to summarize elements of Lacan's thought that we're using. This will probably be very familiar to some of you, and others maybe not. So bear with me. I'll try to summarize what are kind of complex things in a condensed and straightforward way as possible. Lacanian theory, among other things, details the relationship between the realm of language, also known as the symbolic order, and what is called jouissance, which VG defines as a senseless libidinal surplus experienced as a lack, which is inerasable from the symbolic field, i.e. from any knowledge. And jouissance is the product of symbolic processes that excrete this excess, so to speak. It's also sort of the missing catalyst, maybe, but we can know it more sort of as the excess of language. And so language, or the signifier, is beset by contradiction and incompletion, and inherently runs up against the wall of its own inability to constitute a closed system and fully account for reality out there. This is often referred to as the slippage of the signifier, or the play of meaning, which is always constituted through the shifting relations between signifiers. And in Lacan, lack is kind of the absent motor of the unconscious, the point of trauma or loss or desire that dictates our subjective relationship to our environment. This also gets called objet a, the thing in us that insists or persists, the object cause it. Oh, wow, you already finished it. Great. You have to see right there, the object of surplus, the material embodiment of a lack. It often gets used to describe what may seem like very different entities. For instance, Zizek often places an emphasis on object A's manifestation of a specific property of a desirable object, you know, the element of the thing, or the more in the thing than itself that renders it desirable. For instance, you know, the curve of her lip, or the twinkle in his eye, or, I don't know, something on the Hitchcock screen, etc. So Bruce Fink tries to capture the, you know, manifold ways that we might see manifestations of object A. He calls it the residue of symbolization, the real that remains, insists, and exists despite symbolization, as the traumatic cause, as that which interrupts the smooth functioning of the law and the automatic unfolding of the signifying chain, as the last remainder of the hypothetical mother-child unity, as the other's desire, as the jouissance object, as that part of the mother that the child takes with it in separation, and sort of this kind of lost memory or, you know, experience of something that maybe never was, as the foreign, fateful cause of the subject's existence that he or she must become or subjectify in analysis. And so as the object of desire and loss, which in a sense anchors our subjectivity, its presence is invisible and omnipresent. And ultimately, we can't really understand it because through it we encounter the void, sort of like a positive manifestation of the void, and therefore exceed linguistic or conceptual analysis at some point. And because of this, our relationship with enjoyment is never unproblematic, can't be fulfilled by the quenching of basic needs. And this unconscious surplus of sense might cause us to fixate on something without quite knowing why, or imbue certain objects with a mystifying sense of density or meaning. Without ever quite being able to get a hold of jouissance, we are perpetually confronted with traces of its presence and causal power. So, taking this long detour to return to Marx, we agree that living labor is the essential source of value, and that capitalism aims at the valorization of the use values that labor creates. But we reject the derivation of value from an abstracted block of socially necessary labor time that can be, you know, brought to the light of day as the ultimate truth of capitalist production. And our wager is, in some way, this underestimates the unconscious roots of value. And we think that the valorization process attempts to capture or control something real in the Lacanian sense, or beyond signification in some way, rather than strictly, you know, a concrete entity like labor time. And the structure of social relations the big other, desire and contingency, always play a role in generating the value of a commodity. And while Marx's value theory refers to the socially necessary labor time within a specific industry, the very fact that forms of labor are obviously not compensated evenly across the economy seems to point to the fact that different commodities and commodity-producing labor are valued quite differently for reasons that have very little to do with abstractly measured time. So this leads me to the question of the value of knowledge and its relation to labor. So, of course, all labor, whether one is a sophisticated knowledge worker in the information economy or, you know, a peasant planting crops based on the wisdom of ancestral understandings of the climate's natural cycles, is generated through knowledge of some kind, enmeshed with the creativity and life force of the worker, which rests upon a foundation of unconscious knowledge and experience riddled with the messy presence of object A. And VG notes that we can see some evidence of this experience of knowledge arising in a flash, which demonstrates that there are unconscious processes at work. You know, all of a sudden you know how to do something, or you kind of unconsciously know social cues that let you navigate a certain field, etc. We call that knowledge at work. And this process of unconscious knowledge production always creates a surplus of energy that is, in a sense, lost, or, as Alenka Zupanchik puts it, there is something in the status of work or labor which is identical to the status of enjoyment, namely that it essentially appears as entropy or loss, an unaccountable surplus of a work process or signifying operation. So now I'm going to introduce this matrix, hopefully as quickly and simply as I can, and I think Vaho is going to use it to sort of further elucidate specifically our response to Doug. So this Lacanian matrix is a way of elucidating the relations between surplus knowledge and power and how they're sort of, mediated within different social forms. I'm going to introduce the first three, I think, and maybe Vaho will sort of step in or tag team with number four.
If we have time. Yeah, like tell us if we want to split this.
Yeah. So this is the basic matrix actor, the hegemonic seat of power in the discourse. Then underneath the bar, you have the truth of the actor's position, sort of the, you know, that he's split or incomplete in some way, barred, yeah. And this is the other of the discourse that power acts upon, and then there's a product. It's pretty simple in a way. We have these four different terms. They get substituted through the matrix in these different configurations that Vaho laid out. They're always sort of in the same order, but they flip based on a quarter turn. So in the master's discourse, we have S1 in the hegemonic seat of power. It's the master signifier. Sort of the most important thing about it is that it's a one in some way. It organizes and structures the multitude. It might be the ego in the, you know, field of the subject, or the, a king, you know, that in some way acts upon the social body. It can inspire a sublime surplus of meaning or even mystical attachments. I think Zizek talks about this a lot. So in the master's discourse, S1 acts upon S2, which is knowledge. It might be literal knowledge, you know, about how to produce things, but it can also stand for people, the social field as such, you know, wherein knowledge is stored, or the ego acting upon the unconscious. You know, in some way, this multitude of signifiers and knowledge gets, you know, exploited, or, you know, has things in some way expropriated from it, from S1. Underneath the bar, it's split subject. It's the Lacanian sort of model for subjectivity is split between, you know, conscious and unconscious, you know, alienated from desire, etc. And the product of this is object A, the, you know, excess, surplus, that in some way the master's attempt to control the life world produces an excess that can't be fully integrated. So the thing about these discourses is they can be used more as like a formalist matrix that, you know, can be substituted into any situation, but it's also possible to do a more historicist reading, and I think that's kind of what Vigi is doing in this book, wherein he's sort of using the master's discourse as a model for feudalism or absolute monarchy, where it's very clear where the power is coming from, more so. And then as we move into modernity, capitalism, post-modernity, we move more and more into the university discourse. You see it's a quarter turned backwards. In a way, the knowledge or the power gets more obscured in this discourse. So now we have knowledge in the seat of power, and underneath it, the barred truth is that the master is still sort of in control to a certain extent, influencing the hegemonic power, but knowledge describing itself as rational, detached, scientific, now acts upon the desire of the worker. And the way we see that happening is that, you know, under capitalism, knowledge is sort of, in a sense, sucked out of the workers and comes to be possessed more directly by the capitalists. You know, peasants, even if they didn't own anything that they lived on, sort of possessed the knowledge of how things were made more, maybe, you know, enmeshed in their life world more concretely than a worker in an iPhone factory for whom knowledge is this completely sort of abstract thing given from above. And so now it's kind of, rather than power dictating, you know, knowledge, which has its own sort of place as an other to power, knowledge is on the side of power. And we see that kind of as part of the surplus that is being sucked out of workers under capitalism. The last discourse I'll mention is the hysteric discourse. Here, the alienated subject is acting upon the master, demanding things, complaining about, you know, the way he is a master. Her desire or his desire, not really gender specific, is the barred truth of his position. And then knowledge is produced, like, through the analytic relationship or something. So that's kind of my presentation. I hope it wasn't, like, too much all over the place. But Vaho's going to sort of pick up where we left off. Thank you.
So Ashley,
Ashley, you'll go next.
You're next.
Right. Okay. See, this is why I was hoping I would go right after Doug, because I'm torn now between throwing out my entire talk that I had prepared and asking some questions.
Well, we'll have time to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so why don't you do your talk and then
okay. We'll have time to... Because it doesn't really flow well from what's just okay. What's just been said, which I really want to jump into. But basically what I want to do is I want to look at the broader context in which I think psychological redefinitions of the labor theory of value, sort of the subjective definitions of value that have come from, which I would characterize this understanding of value with that, and I would agree with Doug that this is essentially subjective value theory, which is kind of where I wanted to ask some questions and clarify some points. But I wanted to sort of situate this tendency within a broader sort of trend toward criticisms of capitalism that are largely psychological. And I think that part of this, although this particular debate is actually grappling with the labor theory of value, and my hope is that value does become something that we do debate more often. But I think actually the broader issue that we have on the left is a more or less complete abandonment of any economic critique of capitalism, or a critique of capitalism that doesn't start on the capitalist's own terms, you know. So, and this economic critique of capitalism was once the foundation on which was built a future-oriented hope for a communist alternative. And so it's really difficult to express the importance and the impact of the loss of the economic critique. The repudiation of the radical economic critique by the majority of those identifying with the leftist label, that is the rejection of, you know, the idea that value ultimately comes from the worker, from labor power, severely restricted critiques of capitalism and has deprived them of their ability to represent a serious threat to the existing order. And in fact, what's happened is that lacking a strong understanding of the capitalist system and confining ourselves to personal, cultural, and psychological critiques of the status quo, the predominant critical outlook of today often actually winds up presenting a dangerous mirror image, I'll give a few examples, and even reaffirmation of the dominant ideologies it claims to criticize. So the rejection of a totalizing critique of the economic system and implicit acquiescence to an ethos of no alternative, as you know, Margaret Thatcher was famous for repeatedly saying there is no alternative, the fact that we all sort of accept that, has confined criticisms to this or that element of the capitalist system, as though, to paraphrase Zizek, just as we can have our coffee without caffeine, we can have our capitalism without its destructive essence. You know, a capitalism without growth, capitalism without X, Y, Z. More significantly, filling the vacuum left behind by the economic critique have arisen romantic and psychological critiques, which I think are linked, of a capitalist system, and that's kind of what I want to focus on. And I think there are a lot of reasons why we're at this point now where we've abandoned this critique, and I think the obvious one is, well, you know, the cultural side of it is, and the intellectual side of it is this abandonment of totalizing meta-narratives that attempt to monopolize interpretations of reality. We really don't like that. The idea that you could have one narrative that explains everything, that strikes us as terrifying. And part of the reason for that is that, you know, this optimism that existed in the 1930s was just brutally destroyed by the Second World War. And really, the taking stock of the 20th century has led most people to think that, you know, anyone who thinks they have all the answers is going to do untold violence to, you know, bring about their particular idea of the world. You know, two world wars, the Holocaust, gulags, the rise of Stalinism, the beginning of the realization of the failures of really existing socialism, all of these things combined to shake our faith also in progress, which was reflected in Marxism and the Marxian hope of transcendence, that this particular system could be transcended, now strike us as perilously naive. And as a result, the past half century has been characterized by a deep disillusionment with big ideas, of which the labor theory of value is one, that promised to explain society and which could be wielded to radically change them for the better. So in a climate where the vocabulary of critique has been so narrowed, where we don't have these totalizing narratives, we've seen the rise of sort of single-issue politics. But also, what we've lost, and I think not just on the left, but I think in society, what we're grappling with is this loss of an anchor for truth. You know, ideology has always needed to anchor themselves in something beyond the individual to have meaning, and the individual life also needed to be anchored to something beyond itself to have meaning. In Chantal Dalzell's Icarus Fallen, she talks about the individual or the individual as a sign that, you know, the sign being famously made up of the signifier and signified, that you were the signifier of something else, and now that's gone, and we've lost sort of the anchor in religion and transcendence in truth that comes from God. We've lost the anchor for truth that situated itself in the future. So, for instance, you know, we know that we don't really have free speech now within capitalist society, but the ideal of free speech could be anchored in a future in which, you know, there is some real equality. But since that anchor is gone, since society has no future, these sorts of ideals no longer have any meaning. And so without these sort of transcendent anchors for truth, we increasingly anchor truth in the self, in psychology, initially in the psyche, then the self, and now arguably the brain. That's where truth resides. So I think that's sort of the context in which psychological critiques arise. And I think also, in the vacuum left behind by these big sort of meta-narratives, we've seen the rise of the romantic critique of capitalism, which I think is very closely connected to the psychological critique of capitalism. So the romantic critique is characterized by the rejection of, among other things, the quantification, mechanization, and alienation of the present. And it's always existed within capitalism. Marx referred to it in the Grundrisse as capitalism's legitimate antithesis that has always accompanied capitalism and will accompany it up until it's the latter's bitter end, he wrote. And it was legitimate because it was anti-capitalism. Romantic anti-capitalism was the ironic ideological justification for capitalism. So, for instance, you would reject, like, when a commodity becomes mass-consumed, you reject that, and you go, oh, I don't want that, and you want something new, something that everybody else doesn't have. Maybe you want experiences or something like that. And ironically, this sort of fuels the desire for new things and so on. And that's just part of it. But in the last decades, I think this romantic critique has acquired a renewed salience, becoming what several theorists have analyzed as an essential feature of modern culture. Romantic anti-capitalism essentially represents what Michael Sayre and Robert Lowy refer to as a, quote, cultural protest against the modern industrial capitalist civilization in favor of pre-capitalist values. So rejecting industrial society's sterile quantification, the romantic longs for a re-emphasis upon the qualitative, or those values left off the balance sheets of modernity, and for a return to a time, real or imagined, in the pre-capitalist or less developed capitalist past, when those aspects of the world being lost were still present. Early romantics set, as Raymond Williams put it, quote, the idea of an ordered and happier past against the disturbance and disorder of the present, end quote. But what is different about the romantic impulse of the present is that it's far less likely to sincerely desire a real return to the past in face of the uncertainties of the present. Although some people do want this, some people actually say, you know, we want to go back to some fictional sort of communal past. Rather, in a context in which modern society has no future, the present gains exponentially in importance. The desire, then, I think, is for stasis. And in this resigned or reformist incarnation of romanticism, while intensely critical of the present, there's nonetheless an acceptance of its inevitability. Instead of fixating on a moment in the past, the contemporary romantic hopes that the problems and excesses of the present be ameliorated through restoration of the values and virtues that are missing. The resigned romantic bears a conviction that the old values can be reinstated, but the measures advocated to reach it are limited to reform. And therefore, there's, evolution of consciousness and so on. And there's often, therefore, a striking contrast between the radicalism of critique and the timidity of solutions. As a number of writers within this paradigm have remarked, if modern life is the disenchantment of the world, romantic anti-capitalism seeks its re-enchantment through imagination. So where does the psychological come into this? Well, my own research looks at the rise of happiness as an ostensible critique of capitalism. That is, happiness is often counterpoised to economic growth as a radical alternative for society. So if only societies measured happiness and happiness were the goal, then we would not have all these problems. Now, rather than economic growth or something. Now, aside from an imaginary world of markets without growth, the solutions proposed essentially reflect a desire for the re-enchantment of modernity through juxtaposition of quantitative and qualitative accounts and widespread re-education in more virtuous pre-capitalist truths and values about happiness. There's an idealization of the exotic and a conviction that solutions to the problems of today can be sought in lost wisdoms, less developed countries, or in its more radical varieties, be returning to a point in the capitalist past when the socioeconomic system was less developed. So, for instance, there's a documentary called Happiness Economics that presents the example of the semi-feudal relations in Ladakh, a remote region of northern India bordering Tibet, as this ideal sort of happiness-producing area, and completely ignores the fact that it is pretty repressive and essentially, as I said, semi-feudal. Now, this is actually to be expected because typically associated with small producers whose precarious position finds them, as Marx and Engels describe, constantly hurled down into the proletariat by the action of competition. Romantic anti-capitalism has historically held an ambivalent relationship to working class movements. It's therefore a little surprising then that the romantic viewpoint has expanded and generalized in an era characterized by the latter's decline, in which capitalist relations of production have been depoliticized and naturalized. As contestation over production that traditionally characterized left-wing politics has waned, political disagreements have been confined to the realm of consumption. Divorced from the industrial base, modern consumer society finds it difficult to imagine organizing, expanding, and enhancing industrial productive forces toward a future that's radically different from the present, and instead being attracted toward anti-industrial, feminized, and emotional ideals. So, although romantic anti-capitalism has a revolutionary side, the problem is that it tends to deflect attention from the deeper aspect of the problems that we have, that it tends to encourage a focus on the psychological suffering that arises out of capitalism, rather than penetrating deeper to look at the roots of these issues in their sort of systemic causes of the problems that face us. And it encourages a kind of dreaming in place of a rational attempt to actually understand the system. Now, the romantic yearning for the reenchantment of modernity has often taken the form, as I said, of an emotional or psychological critique of the present. Now, this might be useful as part of a broader movement, but, you know, for example, the idea that capitalism causes depression, for instance. But I think if the problems of capitalism are primarily psychological, then I would invite therapy as a solution, because it seems, you know, to radically overturn an entire economic system because it makes some people sad seems like overkill. I think one of the reasons why criticizing capitalism in primarily psychological terms, in terms of how it makes people feel, is that it offers a morally neutral means of connecting with the broadest possible audience. But I think it does it at great cost. So, for example, the critique of work often takes the form of the critique of work stress. You know, modern organization of work causes people to be stressed out, depressed, and so on, conducive to mental illness. But what's interesting is that the word stress didn't actually exist as a dominant frame for negative experiences of work until quite late, until about the 1960s. And it's difficult to imagine that the organization and structure of work in the 1960s was much, much worse than, say, during the Industrial Revolution. If you look at Marx's Capital, there are all these sort of vignettes of what it was like for industrial workers, you know, at the time, where, you know, there's a story of a woman who was forced to work, you know, I can't remember, like 32 hours straight to meet some deadline for dresses, and she just literally drops dead. You know, children being used in factories, people having their limbs ripped off, and yet they didn't use the word stress. And I think it's interesting because stress is kind of the individualization of the negative experience of work that used to be expressed through, broader narratives, like, you know, broader social movements that existed at the time, you know, workers' movements and so on. And those, when those have dwindled, it opens the way for this sort of individualized understanding. So in practice, what is intended as a totalizing critique of the structure of work has actually produced a minimal and therapeutic response. I mean, at my workplace, I'm offered, you know, Wellbeing Wednesdays, where we sit around and meditate, which does nothing to do, you know, for my workload. In fact, it takes an hour out of my day where I feel like I have. So in practice, it's producing minimal therapeutic response. So the psychological critique of capitalism's main claim is that capitalism causes mental illness. In its revolutionary form, the argument is that capitalism must therefore be superseded. But there are at least three things wrong with this argument. First, it posits a fragile vision of the human subject and unwittingly echoes the dominant construction of human beings as powerless victims of circumstance, not powerful actors, capable of consciously bending history to our will. And I think that's the really, really important thing here, is that this brings up questions of what it means to be human that we're not really talking about anymore, and that were, I think, a key part of what Marx was talking about, that the, what it means to be human is incredibly open. And we now have a very, very restricted sense of what it means to be human, in the sense that, you know, if X, then Y. If you have a bad experience, you will be damaged. And this is really powerful in terms of convincing people that there's something wrong with capitalism. But the trade-off is that to get people to listen to you for 5 minutes, you give up on the possibility of human emancipation, because if what defines us as human beings is our essential vulnerability to, you know, psychological damage, then freedom isn't an aspiration. Freedom is a problem. It's people's freedom that we need to control. And I have a lot of trouble trying to explain this to people when people bang on about freedom of speech, whatever. And I said, this means nothing to people. You know, because people are not seen anymore as robust, as capable of, you know, bending the world to our will. In fact, the idea of, like, you know, the idea of humans rationally taking control of history is seen as terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. But that used to be the goal. And so I think when we sort of bang on about the psychological effects of capitalism, and we redefine alienation from its essentially material form to its a psychological form, what we do is, yeah, it's good to communicate with people. Nobody needs to understand the labor theory of value. Nobody needs to understand surplus value. But you redefine what it means to be human in terms of damage. And the solution to the problem, if the main issue with capitalism is its psychological wear, who's to say that what comes after won't be really disorienting for the fragile human psyche? And in fact, the means of getting there, I mean, if you actually really want to overturn capitalism, it's not going to be fun or pretty. It's not going to be a party. It would be pretty awful, probably bloody, if you're really serious that that's what you want. How can these fragile sorts of people possibly deal with that? You know, these are not the types of people that, this is not a conception of the human being that meshes well with, for instance, you know, the Spanish Revolution, the Spanish Civil War, and the sort of individual that it was that people tried to put into existence in the 1930s. So there is more than a hint of a naturalized vision of human beings being communicated in psychological critiques, as though there is an eternal human nature that's out of step with the current system, and to which society must be made to harmoniously conform. You know, if we could just understand what human nature is, right? We'll have that understanding, and then we'll move things around like on a chessboard or something, and get the perfect social organization. And this actually reminds me of critiques at the end of the 19th century between utopian and scientific socialism, in which that very argument was put forward, and we're seeing this put forward again and again and again. But in that debate, Plekhanov wrote, I think, one of my favorite quotes, which is, he says, either human nature is invariable, and then it explains nothing in history, which shows us constant variations in the relation of man to society, or it does vary according to the circumstances in which men live, and then, far from being the cause, it is itself the effect of historical evolution. That is, what makes us human, what makes us different from other animals, is that we work on the world, and in so doing, we work on ourselves. We become something fundamentally different because the way that we engage with the world is different. Because the economic base of society is different, we are, as human beings, fundamentally different than we were. So our resilience and capacity to refashion society, and in so doing refashion ourselves, underpins not only our current condition, but also our ability to revolutionize that condition in the future. And I think that the redefinition of value in psychological or otherwise non-material terms allows for some potentially politically expedient arguments. So, for example, the idea that Facebook is exploiting people. So, you know, we're on Facebook and we sense that there's something not quite right in this. You know, we get the service for free, and we feel as though we are being exploited. And I think a lot of the theorists that have been redefining the labor theory of value have sort of seized on that and said, you know, really, as Facebook users, we are being exploited. I don't know if that actually makes sense mathematically. I think it actually probably is pretty easy to understand in terms of rent, in terms of skimming off profits from productive sectors, and perhaps maybe the selling of information might have something to do with that. But I'm not convinced that it requires a fundamental rethinking of the labor theory of value. But I think sometimes this lack of certainty about precisely what capitalism is and why things go wrong has led us to put forward solutions and has led to movements on the left and a lot of disorientation when it comes to what social justice is. So, for example, one of the things that I found really disturbing, sorry, I'm going on here for a long time, I'll wrap it up in a second, is this trend toward firing people. So this idea that, you know, this person said this bad thing on Twitter, off with their jobs. You know, I'm really trying to grapple with why that's happening. And anybody familiar with older leftist movements is horrified by that, because the idea that the left would campaign for people to lose their jobs is pretty shocking and a big turnaround. But I think part of this is obviously, of course, the decline of working class solidarity. But the rise of consumer activism in its place. So what's happened is that people feel themselves to be exploited, not as workers, but as consumers. And the only voice that people have, they feel they have to effect change, is not as workers. That's an identity that's alien to most people, but through consumption side politics, so as consumers. And this has led to this idea that it's not capitalists doing the exploiting, but workers, you know, because the worker stands between you and the commodity. It seems like they have all the power. And so the idea is, well, that's the person with the power. Let's get rid of them, because the capitalist is perfectly happy to give you whatever you want, right? You know, this is out of step with our values and so on. So they fall all over themselves to capitulate to whatever insane things are demanded, whereas customer satisfaction is just another thorn in the worker's side.
We want to be able to go back and forth, so we can give them a chance
That's all I wanted to say is when we lose that, we get so disoriented that I think we've seen this huge flip around where we've lost our identity as workers, and therefore we feel ourselves to be mainly powerful as consumers. And this has led to, I think, a severe disorientation on the left. And I think with my last point, the economic critique offered a totalizing vision, by contrast, in which the problems of capitalism lay not in its quantification, not its estrangement from the past, not in the minds of passive individuals. Instead, the problems lay in the system itself, its ironic tendency to both create and destroy, to free and imprison, to give us a hint of what the future could be, but no way to get there. And the way forward is not, therefore, to ruminate upon the ill deeds of the rich or the suffering of the poor, but to focus on the potentials of the future being kept from us at a sincere appraisal of the system itself. And I think if we can do that, then we might figure out a way to get there.
I'll clap you for my talk.
All right.
I'm going to try to already respond and kind of lead into questions, but I do want my own time because I think that this was a little bit more of kind of hitting on all parts of the body, but that's fine by me. Just I do want to also get into more MMA style here. A lot of things that Ashley has said are very true in my opinion. For example, the fact that confusion as such is happening. Mia started describing these four discourses, and she said that transition to capitalism and fully commodified, or the kind of ideal capitalist society that we've been seeing for the last several hundred years, has been from this discourse to this discourse. These discourses are always split. Doc said that, you know, there is abstract labor and real labor in the commodity in a certain way. And this abstraction is very important. I agree that abstraction is important. And here, maybe Ashley didn't realize whom she was debating with. She's not debating people who don't have totalizing idea of the system.
Yeah, I realized. That's why I said I wanted to throw my talk.
Yeah, no, it's you know, and it's okay. I mean, we haven't written books, you have, and so it's not clear maybe where we're coming from. Definitely psychology is not psychoanalysis. Actually, psychoanalysis tries to separate itself from psychology exactly because it believes that psychology is this kind of capitalist discourse of kind of objectivist science that, so here in a more kind of traditional setup, pre-capitalist setup, here is the master, here is the slave, and knowledge was on the side of the slave. This S2 was kind of this body of knowledge, the big other that we call it, that was knowledge, how to produce things, and this was not necessarily on the side of the master. Master only knew how to produce things, but these days, you know, psychologists, for example, know how you should live every little part of your life. Our critique of Marx and Lacan's and Zizek's, I would say, and Fiji's, is that in a certain way, Marx is a psychologist, and Marx is a person who, exactly to give the future to the working class, ends up over-valorizing everything in his totalizing theory, and totalization is not a problem. But what happens with structuralism, these are people from 60s, France, Althusser and Lacan, is that this totalizing theories, they don't reject them as postmodernists, they don't relativize them, and they don't say that, well, you know, we can't be so certain and such. They, and especially Lacan, ends up doing certain thing to this totalizing theory. He ends up saying that this big other is always also the theory is big other, also no body of knowledge that also Marxist theory represents is always barred, so is always incomplete because it's language, and exactly materiality of language does not allow anything that is in language to be completed. And not only theory is in language, also every human activity happens in the language. This discourse is a social link. When actor conducts what is can be said an act of speech towards the other, for the person in the position of the other. And this act of speech is also any other act that binds social relations. And of course, labor is one of those acts. And what capitalism attempts is to valorize the labor, the valorize the worker, ascribe it objective knowledge. And in a certain way, VG and others, and I agree, claim that, for example, if you take surplus theory of value, the substance of surplus value is supposed to be surplus labor time that is identical to other measures of labor because of its relation to the society as a whole. So it's a totalizing theory socially necessary labor, it's called, and it claims that there is some substantial quantifiable loss that worker experiences, and as a result of expropriation of this loss transitions through commodity to dominating class. So commodity has what's called use value, which is supposed to be also something very material and real, that is exactly embodiment and transition of surplus labor that was appropriated beyond need, what was said, needed labor for just reproduction of worker and workers' life. What Lacan is saying that it was very important for Marx to create totalizing theory that deals with surplus. But what Lacan is saying that in order for us to continue creating theories based on surplus, we need to really boil down theory to that real of the structure that is able to show relation between surplus and lack. The Bart subject presents also lack. And so Mia mentioned quarter turns. If Masters' discourse, quarter turns, the traditional pre-capitalist discourse or the discourse of more kind of society running itself without being fully valorized, turns itself into this fantasy of full valorization, then the next turn, you see, counterclockwise, the next turn would be putting this S2, as I said, is theory, the body of knowledge of our theory, underneath the bar, in the place of truth. And Lacan says that only in the place of truth is theory able to function as a truly analytic scientific theory. But what ends up in a place of actor? We see that surplus itself, the object, identification with the object, ends up in the place of the actor, which is, I would say, not a psychological position, because what identification happens with very material loss. But that loss is not something that at the same time can be substituted by its kind of form. So it is a place for something in a system that goes beyond language, that is unsymbolizable, and only placing something like that within the system allows us to have system complete. Now, Marx did exactly the same thing. He put something in the system that was very confusing, which is time. What is time? How does this time transition from one class to another? How is it really so substantial to surplus value? Right, this was necessary, I agree, to make it, you know, as it was said, sound more promising for the future, for the more, as it was said, masculine, you know, sense of power, and that we have ability to then take that surplus, quantify it, redirect it to the good of the community, and that will abolish it. That will eliminate. What we see in discourse theory, what Lacan shows us, and he's trying to do it in a very boiled-down way, and sorry, maybe one panel is not enough to explain it, but what he's trying to show is that in this speech act, not only we can't really articulate our truth, and it's constantly barred from us in every discourse, but also that this attempt of speech is also failing, and we never can produce exactly what we demanded for. Master can never tell its slaves exactly what it wants, because, again, it's barred from its own self, so it's not going to be able to fully deliver its own message. Language is alienating us from our own self. So this theory is actually taking language and mechanization farther. But the problem is, that language and mechanization and alienation, through language farther. But again, I think this is a very materialist alienation. I disagree that it's exactly the fundamental alienation. But it is more feminizing because it says, we're so confused, not only because capitalists took away from us the theory, knowing how to do things, our unconscious, so to say, knowledge at work is exactly an analytic idea that happens underneath the presented actor of the discourse. So, stress is a very material condition, and the reason why it's become a popular word to talk about it is because we don't have other words to talk about how we're feeling. This knowledge has been extracted. So Lacan claims that surplus value is fundamentally surplus knowledge, and surplus knowledge is never going to be identical to itself because it is alienated exactly through itself, from itself. And therefore, we can't really, for example, say what was lost from the worker that it's going to be...
This is recording it, so I'm going to put it right.
Yeah, okay. When we were talking about, what went wrong with emancipatory movement, I think that, of course, blaming the opposing forces is important, but I think that this is dedicated to critical reconsideration of what went wrong within praxis, and this kind of structuralist approach always traces problems in praxis to theory, right? So if we're tracing problems to theory, to Lenin, to Stalin, to Marx, that requires to be traced all the way to Marx, and I think that there is a wide variety of people on the left who believe that emancipatory project was also failing because of kind of this attempt to valorize time in Stalinist Soviet Union. I was born in Soviet Union, and I can tell you that the most controlled thing was exactly free time. So the idea that in a transitional or utopian society, somehow free time was going to be that emancipatory element turned out exactly otherwise. And today we do have a reality of people believing that they belong to more than one class. And ideology is playing a very fundamental role exactly because of the advancement of capital and commodification of every element of our life. But exactly this requires emancipatory theory that is not falling into the same trap of university discourse of trying in the name of some powerful promises and hopes for rational willpower wielding the future of mankind to ignore a very important development in the emancipatory theory that I don't think is refuted, which is that if we want to deal farther in the name of scientific dialectical materialism, we need to be recognizing the linguistic problem and be working on this kind of level. This is an ethical system for Lacan, first and foremost, how knowledge can be worked with or any social link can be worked with in general. This is the kind of bottom that we need to hit. And I just want to finish by reading the Zizek's quote. It is very surplus that recreates the lack and its lack it is supposed to fill in, so that we should never radicalize Hegel's formulation. So we should even far radicalize Hegel's formulation. It is not only that despite the excess of wealth, civil society is not rich enough. It is very excess of wealth that makes it not rich enough to get rid of poverty. In other words, the key question is, if there is a surplus,
excessive wealth on the one side and lack poverty on the other side? Why can't we reestablish the balance by simply redistribution, taking the wealth from those excessively rich and giving it to the poor? The formal answer, because the lack and surplus are not located within the same space where they are just unequally distributed. Some people lack things, others have too much. The paradox of wealth resides in the fact that the more you have, the more you feel the lack. It's against the superego paradox. The more you follow the injunction, the more guilty you are. So, you know, of course, this can be called bourgeois, or this can be said that this is a kind of a problem that all of the society is dealing with, because, again, doesn't seem like the upper class has necessarily requested exactly what it's getting, but there's definitely loss. But I think we have to be cautious about the future. And Žižek, just this is one last sentence before we continue. This doesn't mean that we cannot change the future. It just means that in order to change the future, we should first not understand, but change our past. Reinterpret it in such a way that opens up towards a different future from the one implied by the predominant vision of the past. So that's kind of my answer to the critique for now, so I don't... But we have time to debate.
Some questions. Thanks.
Thank you. That would be good to kind of face the audience.
Okay, well, we've certainly got a whole lot to think about here. Those are four quite detailed presentations there. Now, we have to be out of here at 3:50, and that's not much more than 20 minutes. I was going to throw a question at the two sides here, but I don't want to shortchange the audience here because of question and answer. So if there are people who have a question they want to ask, throw up your hand, and if there's a lot of people, I'll forego. I guess there's just one for now. So, all right, I'll tell you what, why don't you ask your question, and then we'll see how it goes, and then I'll jump in myself there. So please go ahead.
Sure. So forgive me because I'm not super familiar with like the Lacanian terminology, but this idea of like the surplus as this like libidinal surplus that can't be like somehow reincorporated into the productive society or something like that. Is this a historically specific term? Meaning like is this something that's specific to like unfree societies like capitalism, feudalism? It's something that could be transcended. And then the second point I'll say is that the labor theory of value, as we're talking about, is not something that's actually new to Marx. Like, Adam Smith, Ricardo had already come up with this idea, and Marx is actually critiquing the political economy of Smith and Ricardo, and the thing that they left out from the problem that Marx had to deal with that Smith and Ricardo didn't have to deal with was the Industrial Revolution and the possibility of overcoming labor as the measure of value. Right? So, I guess... For me, I want to hone in on this idea of historical specificity, like the surplus value and the labor theory of value is one that's historically specific to capitalism and something that, like, the Industrial Revolution pointed towards the overcoming of.
So that's my main point, basically, that it's not, that it's undiscernible kernel of any activity, human activity, and that it can be engaged with, and, you know, of course, it does not have to remain in the capitalist discourse, but at the same time, there is not going to be a point when surplus is not going to be generated in the society, and what does it mean to have some axioms to deal with the surplus in a non-capitalist way, but still deal with it, and not expect that it's going to just be eliminated, that is...
So I want to address what you said.
Mm-hmm.
I'm with you that the kind of labor value that Marx talked about was historically specific, and it was similar to Adam Smith, what Adam Smith talked about. The difference being that Marx thought that abstract labor and real sensuous labor needed to be understood apart. And may very well have been because he saw what was going on in the Industrial Revolution. And the death of the artisanal class and the way that... which one of these is the one where it goes... This is the one where the worker loses their knowledge, right? But why is that? It's not because of I mean, I don't know why Lacan would say that is happening. Marx would say that's happening because of industrialization, because we don't need the worker to have specialized knowledge in production, but you can rotate workers around the machine and they can press this button this day or work for months and months, you know, pulling a lever. The thing about all of this is that it rings or echoes with Marx. Like this is definitely where the worker is. It's kind of a bizarre little equation, but it makes sense to me. But you can't just throw out, if you're going to remain Marxist, my perspective is, you can't just throw out either the historical specificity of that moment, nor the notion, which is true under capitalism, that we're driven by labor time and abstract labor time. That is what gives commodities values in the market, allows them to exchange. And as far as price gouging goes, that happens, but in Marx's Capital, he threw that out because he could show that when it happens, it doesn't contribute to producing a surplus. When you cheat someone on how much your commodity is worth, all that's happened is that the value has, been moved around. But in the totality, there's not more. You're not going to be able to generate a surplus through cheating your neighbor or cheating the person on the market. It's only through the exploitation of labor. So that would be my answer. That Marx is historically specific. Lacan and Zizek talk about something that I kind of think is being almost Cartesian, weirdly, about human experience as such. As self-reflection as such, which is interesting. I enjoy that. I think it's important to understand, but it doesn't help us understand capitalism as such.
Well, capitalism is...
That there will always be a surplus sort of it steps aside from the question of, well, how do we create a society in which that surplus isn't produced as surplus value? So, for instance, is the surplus created by machines or something like that? It kind of strikes me, particularly the last thing, this excessive wealth versus lack, why can't we redistribute? Well, the paradox of wealth is the more that you have, the more you feel the lack. That strikes me as saying, like, it's greed that's really driving this, and that's the way it's always going to be. But that's positing this sort of idea of essential human nature that we can never go beyond. But also, it's saying it's giving a psychological understanding to what's happening in the system, when actually it doesn't really matter if you're greedy or nice or kind or give to charity. You have to reinvest profits in order to compete. So you have to make a profit, you have to extract surplus value, regardless of how you feel about it.
Can I just respond real quick, you guys? So, structuralism and this kind of analysis of ideology is not postmodern, this is not relative, this is not Derrida. These ideological ways of establishing social relations and Marxist theories as a sociological theory are very material. Ideology is very material. Capitalists believe that they need to progress the society in this way, and this is a very material thing that can blow up the whole world. So the materiality of the signifier is impossible without feminization through the latter, and it's not sexy. I agree. I've dealt with this my whole life, that it's not sexy. But the sexy part is the capitalist part, discursively. If you really boil it down to this kind of work, you start seeing that the sexy part in this way becomes, again, same attempt to valorize what's antagonistic in the society, to overcome the otherness. When in reality, the most emancipatory thing is to put the otherness in the very seat of power. And this is about power. And the fact that it's surplus and unvalorized doesn't mean that it cannot come to power. It doesn't mean that it has to come to power with flowers. But again, I would like to say that, of course, historically engaging in struggles and working class movements has been definitely more empowering. But again, there is that confusion, and definitely there is a confusion of the next day, as Zizek says, and this has been historically shown. And so, you know, we will deal with that confusion. If there are going to be people who want to say that there are exact scientific steps that need to be taken, probably next thing people like me are going to be going to, you know, do some work in Siberian forests.
Okay, before we go on to the next thing, Mia, do you want to jump in on this?
No, it's okay. I was going to say I wasn't really trying to make the argument about price gouging so much as situate sort of the fact that we aren't making necessarily the, you know, argument from that angle.
Okay, got
a question. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, sure. I'm also not particularly well-versed in Lacanian or even Marxist theory, I'm afraid. I'm kind of an outsider here. But what I did sort of like about the conceptualization of this matrix is I like being able to think about this in terms of having different weights within an equation and the idea that you can change those as much as you want, but your argument ultimately is that it sort of does need to be rotated for things to fundamentally change. At least I think that's what you're approaching when you're comparing the analyst discourse versus the university, which appears to be much more of the Marxian conception, which was in a historical context. The difficulty I had, though, was in picturing an example, a practical example, of particularly the analyst one. So I was wondering maybe if we could sort of hypothetically explore what that might be.
Yes.
I just want to point out that we can do that, too.
Yeah.
No, but you can rotate
about
that.
I saw that.
So again, practical implementation would be dealing with the future of movement organization, starting from the place of recognition that there's always going to be surplus produced. Like for me, this is important just very practically in dealing with any situation that no matter how emancipatory somebody tells you that situation going to be, you have to centralize the surplus that will be produced. Like these days, really, surplus is not being accounted for in any relations on the left. You know, it's kind of, again, tried to be glossed over and covered. And so that is the most important practicality that I see it. But in the long run, this doesn't mean some, like, spineless, amorphous, you know, vitalist flow. This is working with a theory, but fundamentally theory here is barred and therefore open. And in a way, what we end up seeing that totalizing theories that don't have a place for surplus as clearly defined then end up in objectivist conundrum. But we definitely need language, we definitely need theory. And one problem I find that, yeah, I mean, for our generation, I don't believe time even makes sense. I was reading Ashley's book. She was talking about surplus compassion. She was, you know, really talking how these, you know, emotional labor and this happiness capitalism, service industry, number one value producer in this country, you know, out of human labor. And so, it has to be problematized. What does it mean to have surplus time? I think because it's not about time. Once you go and you really discharge yourself to the max, something else stays at work.
There was another question, right?
Right. Well, first, Ashley, did you want to respond also on that? Or we can go on to the next question if you're not inclined.
I need to think about it for a second. I'm not sure I understood.
Well, I have one response to you.
Okay, go ahead, Doug, and we'll go to the next question.
Surplus, right? Mm-hmm. Surplus. So you said something during your talk which I wanted to push against, which is that what Marx describes is that the capitalist robs the worker of this time that he could use for himself, right? But the truth is that couldn't happen at all, because the worker by himself can't create the value that's being robbed from him. It's only within the system that abstract labor time becomes a value. So the worker, a revolutionary worker's aim should not be to collect, to get all that time back for himself, or all, or certainly not to get all the commodities that he produced for himself. I mean, most people don't produce things that they need for themselves. They go to work and they produce one thing or two things that then get spread out throughout society. If you take them all home and put them in your basement, they're just going to sit around collecting dust. You're not going to use them all. That's not how capitalism works. It's not a matter of gaining that time back or feeling like you're being robbed. It's a matter of restructuring the reason we go to work. It's a matter of giving ourselves a new task, a new way to work together. So it's not based on trying to create this exploitation. But the exploitation, again, is not of the individual worker. It's only in relationship to labor power, which is a basket of commodities that the worker needs to reproduce himself. And the results of the commodity production at the end of the day, you can see the exploitation as a, just a, you know, a very easy, you know, you just subtract the amount of labor power that was spent and see the rest. And now the rest is the exploitation.
Right. Real quick to respond to that, that's a very, very important point you're making. And I agree, but I think that to agree with that point that the meaning of work has to be somewhat substituted, right? And we call it knowledge at work because it has to be. That this meaning has to be recognized as fundamentally related to the loss and therefore not directly accessible. What we've seen in state socialist programs, for example, and even in a more anarchic environments, was that somebody was assuming the meaning of work. And assuming meaning of work already gives you the power to wield the surplus of work. What the starting point has to be is lack itself, the surplus itself that is meaningless as such in the beginning has to be starting point, and then we arrive to the product of such discourse, which is a new form of meaning and identity. It is, but at the end, not starting from it. That's what this says.
Okay. Go ahead. You.
I mean, I was kind of going that way anyway. I mean, when you...
Go ahead, please. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you to expand on when you were... You said you were in Russia?
Yeah, and Georgia.
That, okay. And that free time was not something... Because I don't know. I disagree that the service value, yeah, like if you work 4 hours and then the next 4 hours decide to be a de facto producer, but labor has become a way of like us to define ourselves, which I think in many socialists, it's like as long as you can sustain the time that you have to yourself, you decide what knowledge you want, you know, to acquire from, you know, if you have half the day to yourself.
Yeah.
But I don't know why, I mean, when you were saying that you don't think it's achievable in any system.
I mean, again, it's very necessary for society to have some meaning and cohesion. It's just the question is how it's being derived.
Because right now it's basically the abyss of like human potential. Like we are reduced to specialization. Like we don't even feel we're going to know less and less about whatever product we're making because it's going to be very complicated and we are just one gear in everything.
Right. But exactly this confusion about being one gear and not having this totalizing knowledge is being dealt with, right? So different ways are offered. So what you mentioned at the beginning, I call workerist ideology, when work is fetishized itself as kind of this having emancipatory potential and a lot of this kind of ideas of kind of this rational reason overcoming nature, then in these countries ends up really having a lot of people, you know, work really hard and, you know, not even have that buy-in into...
But when you mentioned, like, in the we never had, like, a global socialist.
Right.
Why is free time not achievable? Because I think that from this point on, there's not much of a working towards, right? Like, if you're talking about lack or the most desire, like, I think all I am hopeful for is to have free time. So I don't think that's not achievable in any system.
So what do you mean by free time? Just like time where you don't have to go to work?
Time that you're not working, that you decide if you want to spend with your family to have a social bonding, if you want to read, if you want. It doesn't have to contribute to anything, but, you know, the society, like, I guess in a way that, like, plenty would want, you know?
I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is that time itself is very political. I mean, time itself doesn't exist, it's not symbolizable. And so time is not like this thing that you get at the end as a kind of happy product of revolution. Time is exactly some stand-in for something, or object A, or energy or value, is a stand-in for something that is beyond the grasp of the society, and that's the most political thing. That's the center of politics. So free time cannot be apolitical as such. So it actually where things start. Then labor follows from there.
We can take out time and just say freedom can't be apolitical. The freedom, right, to be kind of cliched about it, freedom requires that you take responsibility. You create something, exactly, in which you are, you know, you've developed freedom. And it will be always be of a certain kind of freedom. And under capitalism, I think we've got this kind of freedom where we're alienated from our knowledge, and where we, the only free time that we have is, you know, the weekend, maybe, and that we have consumer choices. And, you know, that is a very good description of the kind of freedom that we experience as consumers and workers. But it's not helpful when it comes to understanding why we're ended up in this position and what we're doing when we are working. And we do need to understand Marx's original theory, which I think we can still defend against the Keynesians and the marginal utility theorists and the Marxists. We can still look at Marx's original theory and we can test it and not correct it in this way. Correct the ideology, but not the original Marxist economic theory. That's my final comment on that.
To add to that, you said that control was exercised in the Soviet Union through time. Like, the idea that work makes us human may have become the ideological justification for extreme exploitation of labor in the Soviet Union, but that wasn't the cause of it. You know, the cause of that was that the material base of society wasn't mature enough to actually have, you know, anything close to communism, and therefore you had to more or less create, you know, introduce, like, Taylorism and things like that. And it wasn't because they misunderstood the nature of labor.
Well, I just believe that right now, you know, we're nowhere near, for people who believe that for the sake of future, that ethical dealings with day-to-day life have to be overcome. We are stuck in a crisis of capitalism forever. For me, as a millennial, theory of stages of historical development of society is a little funny, because I think we're going on a circle or going back. And, you know, this confusion is being dealt with pretty well by right-wing forces. And I think that it's time to boil things down to basic concepts of theory that young people can communicate with today and deal with immediate situations. If it is a little feminizing and disempowering to be dealing with immediate trash in front of us, rather without having clear fantasies of utopia. Well, I mean, the changing things was never easy, and you know, I truly believe that working class exactly has that potential for consciousness to deal with things in its incompletion and such. I feel that oftentimes we have sense of responsibility to offer working class ready-made solutions and take them into populist opportunist directions. But I also think that the working class has more wisdom than it's really to have.
Okay. All right. We just got a couple of minutes here. I want to try to concretize this a bit. So I want to ask this question of the Lacanian side here, whichever one of you two wishes to go up. Now, in the first, in volume three of Capital, right on the at the very beginning there, Marx gives a very concrete one paragraph example of surplus value, how value is extracted from the workers and compensated by the capitalist. And he spends the next three chapters, about another 40 pages, explicating this and looking at it from every possible angle and really tying up all the mathematics out of this. Now, of course, we live in the real world and not in a mathematical world, of course. So what I wanted to ask is your contention that this specific aspect of Marx has been superseded given the financialization of so much of production today, or is that still valid on its own thing, or do we really have to supersede it? I'm trying to grasp, you know, where you're coming from your side.
I mean, I thought that it should be grasped in its historical milieu to be a political text that offers also promises, but I think that what happens with financialization of capital is that we're seeing how it needs to be transcended in a certain way. I mean, for many reasons. I mean, 20th century has shown many reasons, I feel.
But isn't a financialization ultimately a confiscation of surplus value? Isn't surplus value still at the production stage and the stock market and things like that are basically taking surplus value away from industrialists?
Right.
Or is that an oversimplification?
Well, it is not simplified enough. So what this attempts to simplify it all the way to the symbolic knowledge, that what is really being extracted is the surplus knowledge. The means of production have been extracted. That's how capitalism started. But this extraction that continues into the, and always been knowledge extraction, and knowledge is incomplete, therefore that's what really financialization shows us. It bears the kind of bones of impossibility to symbolize things. Spirit is a bone.
Okay, so Ashley or Doug, do you want to give a very quick response to that, or should we hold
on? I'm just confused. If what's being extracted is the knowledge in order, what are you saying? The knowledge of the means of production, that is the organization of work? Is that what you're saying?
Well, they think knowledge is what gives the commodity value to begin with, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
So
then wouldn't you be saying that essentially it's the capitalist being exploited? Or the managers?
Well, that's what effectively ends up being, that the line between proletarian and bourgeois runs in the society in a much more problematic way, exactly because of this commodification process and financialization of capital and late capitalism. And if we want to deal with emancipatory movements, we have to be seeking for a split within both classes or nominated classes, because this nomination is kind of obsolete in certain ways.
Well, then, from that perspective, there actually aren't any classes. There isn't a class struggle then.
Yeah, it's all acting on the level of ideology and psychology, right?
Well, a lot of people, a lot of cases, it's happening on a psychological level or psychic level, but it doesn't mean that you can't find somebody who's benefiting. These courses, I'm sorry, you were not able to see, but these courses show that under any system, almost besides the one that's really oriented onto leg, there is somebody who is benefiting from the situation. It's just to find who is benefiting from the situation, we need to kind of step away maybe from more traditional ways of nominating who's working class, who's bourgeois. Lacan, talking to students in France, 68, was saying that some of the working class people with jobs and stability in France were much more bourgeois than a lot of these students who were coming from bourgeois backgrounds and identifying with lumpen proletariat more than proletariat, because these concepts and traditional way of seeing how work defines class has been problematized by the commodification.
See, I just want to say, when I hear you talk about this stuff, I just can't help but think about sort of a simplified version of the Frankfurt School of philosophers, and where what they were concerned about figuring out is why the workers don't change society, and then they were trying to figure out why it is that they identify with, say, the bourgeoisie, or why they aren't developing a revolutionary consciousness. But were they listening to the wrong kind of music? You know, was it television? This is some other explanation, but it's not an explanation of how capitalism works. It's an explanation of consciousness and how people may or may not be moved to take political action.
Maybe we don't know how capitalism works.
But we do. We wrote Capitalism. Well, we know it.
Last thing.
I think it actually really matters that you know how capitalism works. It matters whether or not you're right. Because if you're right, that means that there's no class struggle. There's actually no point. Yeah, just deal with immediate problems. That's it. There's no point in looking any deeper. Forget about it. It's just that guy over there.
Yeah, that guy over there really needs to figure out things, and with me, find the dogs. But what I wanted to say is that, yes, we don't know how capitalism works. We were talking yesterday at Verso Party, me and Doug, about Bayes' superstructure. Yes, Bayes is material, but exactly because it's material, it's incomplete, and if you look down, Lacanian sees that he's standing or she's standing on a void, not on this kind of like well-defined material, mechanical, calculated basis of perfect theory that's going to take us to the outer space.
Okay, we really have to see the space here. It's been quite a, yeah, we could easily do another session or two of this. Unfortunately, we're out of time and we have to see space. I think people are starting to mass at the door here. So right. Say hello to us. None of us bite here. And I hope we'll continue this conversation.